Khalid is like a banana vendor, and he's like, I can get you to Iraq. You want to go to Iraq? I'll take you to Iraq. And I'm like, really? And he's like, yes. And so the KDP, which is like the Kurdish political party, which has a stronger presence in Iraq, but also an office in Syria.
Yeah.
He like takes me to the office of the KDP in Qamishli. And he's like, this is my friend Rolf, and he wants to go to Iraq. Can we take him there? And like the guy behind the desk is like, Khalid, you're a banana vendor. And he didn't say this, but that was sort of the vibe I got. It's like, I think it's cool that you can take your American friend here, but I'm not going to take this dipshit into Iraq just because...
Not to come back.
Just because he's your friend.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today, Ari Shafir comes back on the show, this time to talk about a journey I took to Syria 25 years ago and why it remains one of my favorite travel experiences. This marks the 12th time Ari has been on Deviate. Seven of those conversations have been about things like magic mushrooms or travel to places like Israel or Las Vegas. Two have been live recordings of my book release events in New York, and today marks the third time I've stolen and remixed one of Ari's own podcast episodes. Our Syria conversation originated as an episode of Ari's UB Trippin' podcast last year, and as usual, our conversation goes all over the place. We talk about what it was like to visit Syria as a low-budget backpacker in the year 2000 and where I stayed and what I saw there. We talk about how some Syrians I met were obsessed with NBA basketball and the Utah Jazz in particular. We talk about the joys of watching the movie Con Air on a bus to Damascus, which leads into a tangent about what it's like to watch American movies in other countries, like seeing Fight Club in Egypt or Titanic in the Philippines or Groundhog Day in Israel or Dude, Where's My Car in India. We talk about smugglers offering to drive me to Iraq and the Sudanese refugees who invited me to sing gospel songs with them in their church in Damascus. And the fact that poor people most anywhere in the world are more likely than rich people to offer travelers hospitality. Ari occasionally refers to photos that he pulls up on the screen in real time. These images aren't essential to understanding the audio conversation, but if you're curious, I've embedded the full video version of Ari's episode in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. You'll see there that Ari does occasional promotional segments for his comedy tours. I should probably do the same thing for my Paris travel memoir writing classes, in part because Ari was a student in those classes a few years ago. For now, I'll just say that if you're interested in taking one of my Paris writing classes in 2025 or some future year, you can find out more information about the dates and prices at pariswritingworkshops.com. I've also linked to those Paris classes in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. Whatever the case, I really enjoyed this conversation about traveling through Syria. Conversation topics include my experience of eavesdropping on James Brown songs in an Aleppo hotel, and the fact that I still own the hiking boots I'm wearing on the cover of Vagabonding, and the joyous ignorance that comes with being in a new place, high on Arabic coffee, and taking an interest in every little detail of the day and just feeling lucky to be there. We start just after Ari asked me when exactly I went to Syria. Let's listen in. I went in the year 2000, so as of the time we're taping this, it was like 24 years ago.
Damn.
But it was also, so that means it's a unique time to see a place. I think sometimes we see things in terms of like the historical moments, and so I think that like the revolution or that thing happened in 2011, like the massacre and the crackdown, the protests and the crackdown, and Syria was like the worst place in the world to be, and there was all these Syrian refugees. So this is 10 years before that. It was actually before 9/11. It was like a year and a half before 9/11. And so even though it's like, oh, well, how relevant can that be? It's like, well, Syrians were Syrians then and they're Syrians now. And there wasn't a war and I went there as a dirtbag backpacker. And I'd like to think that the people I met there are hanging on and doing well. And that's, again, I don't need to preach this to you, just the idea that travel teaches you the stuff that's beneath the headlines. You know, it teaches you like, what kind of snacks you can get in the public square.
Yeah.
It talks about how, you know, random people are interested in the weirdest things like NBA. Like
I had
an intense conversation about the Utah Jazz when I was in Qamishli, Syria.
So, really?
Yeah, yeah.
They follow it? I guess so. Why not?
I don't know how, because at the time you couldn't get it on Hotmail. I guess you could get it on the internet, but you couldn't get like on Hotmail. I'm dating myself in this trip. It was like pre-Gmail. So I couldn't log into my own email when I was in Syria. But news got around, and it's funny, like people, it's interesting what what people are fascinated by across cultural lines. And in this little town on the Turkish-Syrian border, there's enough guys who are interested in the NBA that that's what we talked about.
Well, did they have any players back then? Turkey had like one or two.
Oh, no. But they were talking about, I don't know, Karl Malone. I forget who was playing back then. But they were. This happened in Korea. I lived in Korea for a couple of years. And a lot of my male students were just really interested in the NBA. And there weren't any Koreans in the NBA back then. They just thought it was interesting. You know, American pop culture and sports culture is so influential that I think everywhere.
I mean, yeah. Also back then, probably we were still the dominant basketball, like, powerhouse.
Yeah, and we probably are to an extent, though maybe not in international play. Like, I don't follow that sport. I saw the NBA finals at your house, like when the Raptors won, I think.
Oh, yeah.
It's funny how geography determines what sports you love. And so college basketball is a Kansas thing, but NBA isn't. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't really have a team. Like, I came of age before there was Oklahoma City, which is kind of close. And of course, I love the Bulls because I came of age in the 90s, but I don't really follow the NBA. Like,
it's weird that geography will tell you that. I was doing a show in Knoxville, and I'm like, your biggest sports team is a women's basketball amateur team.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. The Tennessee Vols are like always dominant.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's just the biggest sport there. Women's college basketball.
Yeah. Well, it's men's college basketball in Kansas for understandable reasons.
Yeah. Bill Self, is he still the coach?
Bill Self is still the coach. But now we have, I spoke with Michael Jordan, like there's kids everywhere because of Patrick Mahomes was the quarterback of the Chiefs. There's going to be Chiefs fans in Idaho and Alabama in 20 years, you know, because it's who they grew up with. You know?
Yeah. Okay, so let's go back to Syria.
Sorry. Yeah.
So this is, I'm only good at this for interviewing. We're keeping it back to the country.
Right.
So this is 2000. I mean, tons of questions. How much are hostels? Who'd you meet? How'd you meet them? What'd you eat? Why there?
I think that, and you've understood this in other contexts, that every part of the world has its own backpacker circuit.
Uh-huh.
And so information is coming back and forth on the backpacker circuit. And then, probably more than now, you can sort of default to your phone and see where to stay in any given place. People are like, I was in Damascus, and there's this place, it's an old Ottoman home with a fountain on the inside, and they've warned out the old mansion rooms into bunk rooms, and it's $4 a night. And so I literally wasn't thinking of Syria as a geopolitical thing, but just as a cool place to go that was also in the backpacker circuit that people, Egypt was sort of my hub back then.
Uh-huh.
So people are coming from Jordan. They're coming from other parts of the Middle East. I was going to say Israel, but after you've been to Israel, you can go to Egypt, but you can't go to Syria. You can go to Jordan.
Yeah.
Or Lebanon. I don't think you can go to Lebanon. Anyway.
They do a thing now where they, instead of stamping your passport, they'll sticker it.
Yeah.
And they're like, we know. Go ahead, rip this off when you're done.
Yeah. Although when you get that Egyptian exit pass, sometimes they look for that in Syria. And so I saved Israel for last that year. But you know, I've talked about Israel in our past, for my podcast.
The idea of a hub is interesting because I didn't think of it until you just said it. But like Thailand is the hub for Southeast Asia. You keep going back there and then other countries and back there and other countries.
Totally. Like Bangkok or Chiang Mai is the hub in Southeast Asia. Cairo is the hub in the Middle East. It just makes complete sense. I mean, maybe some people, if Tel Aviv is their hub, then they can't go to certain places. So Cairo just makes the most sense as a hub. What is it in South America? Like maybe
good question.
Cusco or
yeah, like I don't know. It's so spread out.
Ecuador. Well, I mean, there's different. And again,
it'd be like where there's flights to lots of places. It has to be that. It has to be centralized, so you're not thinking long flights.
Maybe Buenos Aires down in the Horn.
Yeah.
And then maybe Cusco or Lima.
Yeah, Peru. Yeah, I don't know.
Anyway, but like so many parts of the world. Well, in Central America, it's Costa Rica. Right?
Right.
So you have a place where you go first.
Go to Colombia, go to Panama, go to
Ecuador. The easiest to travel in. It could be Panama.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
in East Africa, it's probably Kenya. And in South Africa, it's like Johannesburg, probably Cape Town.
Yeah.
So.
And it probably has a different vibe of the travelers because of that.
Right.
They're probably trading stories and giving out information.
Totally. Sydney, maybe in Oceania.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, we've sort of fallen into the backpacker rail here of travel because when you're a backpacker, this is second nature, you know, that your information, especially back then, but probably even now, is that you're sitting and talking to people and it's like, really? You went to you went to a monastery in Syria? Tell me more.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things I'm going to talk about is I went to this monastery that was amazing and it was full of backpackers, which I think annoyed the monks. But and then Damascus was a great travel city. And it's a shame that you can't really recommend that anybody go there now.
It's a dead city in terms of what you saw. It's no longer available.
Yeah, and I have no idea. When we get into the specifics, I can sort of talk about what I saw and speculate on whether or not it might be there. But in some ways, Damascus was like people talk about Havana. I saw a lot of old cars, like really old Buicks.
In Damascus?
In Damascus, yeah. Oh. Like I saw a Mercedes where some guy had taken off all the Mercedes symbols and put in Batman symbols. So that's just how weird the world is. You know, you're talking about the NBA up by the Turkish border. And then some dude has decided to kit out his Mercedes to look like a Batman car. But I loved Syria. It's one of my favorite places. I like Egypt because Egypt is so easy to come in and out of. It's all really cheap there. But Syria was just Syria was like Egypt, but they're less jaded. Like Egypt sees so many tourists, you know, everything from people flying in for a weekend to go to the pyramids to backpackers staying there for half a year. Whereas Syria is harder to get to. It has more of a dangerous reputation. And so Syrians are just so excited to, they meet Westerners, Europeans, Americans less often.
And they were excited to see you?
Absolutely.
Like, give me some examples of like walking to restaurants and stuff.
Yeah. And I guess this happens any place in the world, but like in Damascus, I would go and just sit down in a cafe and, you know, some guy who was playing backgammon would turn to me and ask where I was from. And he was like hoping Germany because he spoke some German. And then you have a conversation. We had a conversation with some guy in Damascus. He's like, Reader's Digest isn't as good as it used to be. And it's like, how on earth do you know about Reader's Digest? And so I think that people everywhere want to be global. And if you're in a place that's sort of been cut off from the rest of the world, like Syria sort of was and is even more now, they were just looking for news from the outside. I mean, it's sort of a dictatorship there.
Was it then?
Yeah, it was the father, Hafez Assad, had almost died. He died like within a year of my visit. And then one of his sons has taken over since then.
Do you think it was related to your visit?
I don't think so. Right. I don't think so. But it was so weird that like back then it was the Ba'athist. It was like the old socialist model of Arab nationalism, like Nasser in Egypt did this. And so instead of like an Islamist cultural identity, I think they maybe aligned themselves with the Soviets when the Soviet Union was a thing.
Yeah.
And of course the Soviet Union was gone by 1990, not for more than 10 years, but they still sort of had, people were walking around sort of wearing olive drab sweaters and the propaganda was sort of old Soviet bloc style propaganda. So it's weird. This conversation is going to be about travel in place, but also travel in time, because I went to a version of Syria that doesn't exist, but I suspect Syrians are Syrians, and I thought Syrians were great.
Wow. Friendly people?
Yeah.
Smiley? Somebody told me, like, Russians don't misread it. They just don't smile, so they're not mad at you. They just don't smile.
Well, I mean, Arab cultures are famously hospitable, and hospitality is one of the pillars of Islam.
Abraham?
But I mean, it's multicultural. I mean, I think Syria was like 10% Christian and there's different sects of Islam. And in fact, the Assad family is, Alawite. They're not Shia or Sunni. They're a different kind of Muslim.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know.
Bath is also Iraq, wasn't it? Wasn't that Saddam's party? It was a Bath party?
Yeah. Sorry. I said, Egypt, but, the Ba'athist, is Iraq. They all had a little bit different flavor of it.
Uh-huh.
I think they had this idea to create sort of this Arab super nation, but of course nobody was on board for that. You know,
dude, my half brother was a captain in the army. I think a captain. His job was to get a provisional government in Afghanistan after the war.
Yeah,
and it took a year of negotiation between the Sunnis, the Shiites, and the Muslims on which percentage should be on whatever.
Well, Sunnis and Shiites are Muslims.
Okay, well, whatever. I don't know.
There's also tribes. Afghanistan is a bunch of tribes. So, like, everybody speaks a different language. And so just the idea of a nation state is a pretty new idea. It's like a 19th century thing. It's like Europeans drawing a map, and it's like, this is going to be a nation state, this is going to be a nation state. So Afghanistan makes no sense.
Well, we've been over it. Anywhere there's a straight line, that's a made-up border. You know, these curvy ones are like, oh, a river, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, or a mountain range or something. But like straight line, it was like some guy in a war room in London was like, it's here.
Yeah. Yeah, Robert Byron said there's something absurd about a land border, you know, that, and actually this came up in Syria because, let's see, I went up into this corner because that was a time when Iraq seemed really exotic because the war hadn't happened that long before. Uh-huh. And so I just wanted to go to the Tigris River and sort of look into Iraq.
Cool.
And so I was sitting in the market or whatever in Qamishli, which is this town that's up by Turkey and Iraq. And actually, I quote this in The Vagabond's Way. The taxi drivers are like, yeah, no, borders are things that exist in the minds of bureaucrats. You want a taxi ride to Damascus? I can take you there. You give me $50, you know?
Whoa.
And they drove Ford Escorts too. Like for some reason, the smugglers drove Ford Escorts 24 years ago.
They're just like, we'll just do it.
And border towns, and that's a river border. So you actually have to cross the Tigris to get into, you can cross the land border here.
Yeah. Oh, weird.
And so it's just, I hung out with the dude who smuggled rubber sandals into Iraq for a living. That's what he did.
Why would they not allow that? I mean, taxes maybe.
I think like embargoes maybe.
Yeah.
Like maybe there was some sort of European rubber sandals that weren't getting there because of some sort of, like, I don't know how far you want to get in the weeds
cool
this
job.
Soon, but like this is back in the day of the no-fly zone.
Uh-huh.
And so the Kurdish part of Iraq bordered on that part of Syria. And so I hung out with Kurds the whole time. So it was different. When I was in Damascus, I was hanging out with, Syrian Arabs, but like Sudanese refugees. And then when I was on the border, I was hanging out with Kurds because like Kurdistan is a place that didn't really win the nation state game. There's never been a Kurdistan nation because after World War I, they split up the Middle East and they decided not to make a Kurdish nation. The cultural area is the size of Texas and it stretches into Iran and Iraq and Syria and Turkey.
Yeah.
But the no-fly zone that the first George Bush established after the Gulf War meant that Saddam couldn't go up and kill the Kurds in northern Iraq. So for at least 10 years, northern Iraq, they could just do what they wanted. And so I was hanging out with these Kurds in northern Syria. And then these magazines that showed like the Kurdish basketball league in northern Iraq, like they were very American influenced back then. And so I think just a lot of aid was happening back then and Saddam couldn't touch them. And so they were just doing their own thing. You know, you leave people to their own devices and they start basketball leagues and you know.
It is cool to see when it's like, hey, what would you be if not for interference?
Yeah, yeah. You know? If you weren't trying to be repressed by somebody else whose geopolitical aims are in this part of the place.
When I was in Myanmar, we were in some northern city and it was like, we saw some store and some cool people like kind of like graffitiing it on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like their store, like, what is this? And they were like, fashion store. It was like the first like, oh, you guys are just getting non-functional clothing. Congratulations.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Way to go.
Yeah. No, and that's a great thing that you see when you travel these places. Most people don't give a shit about the geopolitical situation.
Uh-huh.
They want to put a Batman symbol on their car or...
You scared at all going there?
Not really.
How old are you in this?
I was 29.
29. Yeah. Not scared.
Not scared because all these backpackers were coming back out of Syria and saying, go up to the mountains, there's this monastery and you have to walk the last 20 minutes and crawl into a 3-foot door, but it's cool and it's free and all you have to do is shovel goat shit for a while.
What do you mean, to work there?
Yeah.
What?
It's an exchange, a hospitality exchange. It's nominally a Christian monastery, but it's more like a little hippie encampment. It was founded by an Italian monk in the 1980s.
Yeah.
It's called Deir Marmoussa up in the hills above Damascus, actually.
Yeah.
And then if you look at that map.
Yeah. Do you have any pictures of that? Where am I going?
Oh, the monastery.
Wait, where is this called? I'll look it up. Deir Marmoussa, is that what you said?
Oh, Deir Marmoussa. Yeah, I'm not sure if it'll show up. D-E-I-R space M-A-R space
M-A-R.
M-U-S-A. Yeah. El Nabuk, yeah.
That's not it?
No, that's it.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's it. Literally, I stayed there. So
what? You stayed in there?
Yeah.
Cool. What is this, carved into the fucking mountain?
It's carved in the mountains, and actually that is more finished than when I was there. So they were still building that when I was there. And I stayed like in this little place that was above where the goat stayed and it smelled like goat shit, but it was free. and it was a bunch of dirtbag backpackers. And it's funny because all the backpackers knew about it. Yeah. Like Christian monks are obligated to give hospitality, whoever asks.
Yeah.
And so they just had this this total channel of dipshit backpackers. I say dipshit, but they
you're
meant
obligated,
well.
Huh? You have to.
Right.
Your God commands.
Yeah. And so they just had all these. And so like there was this Swiss guy who decided he wanted to live in a cave and like renounce his possessions.
Yeah.
So the monks are sort of like, okay, yeah, there's a Swiss hermit living in a cave and we're going to humor him. But yeah, no, this is the, wow. The Italian guy went there in the 80s and he restored this place.
Wow.
And it was like Moses the Ethiopian or somebody. It's Dirmar Musa. Musa means Moses. And he was restoring the old frescoes and...
Oh, really? That was like, his like passion?
Syria is just a mix of everything. There's multiple Christian cultures, multiple Muslim cultures, and multiple languages. It's the crossroads of the world. It's this Silk Route. And so you could stay there for free. I washed dishes and Silk I shoveled route. Goat shit and chicken shit. And then there's no electricity there. So you have the oil lamps after dark. There's like Korean backpackers and Argentine backpackers and like people from the village, Muslims in the village were hanging out. Like the monk, his mission was like, cross-religious understanding, you know?
Yeah.
So they had a lot of conversations between the Christians and the Muslims. And it was just sort of this little hippie camp that was just in the middle of nowhere, Syria. It was
people
amazing.
People doing drugs there?
What's that?
People doing drugs there? Backpackers? There must have been hash around.
Probably. I wasn't aware of it at the time. I actually mentioned this place in Vagabonding because there was some backpacker. I say that she was from Canada, but she wasn't really from Canada. I give her anonymity, but she's like, she refused to go to the church services.
Yeah.
And it's like, so you hiked, you like drove way up into the mountains, you walked 20 minutes and you crawled through a little door and you're staying with these monks, but you don't want to be influenced by Christianity, so you're not going to go to the church services. It just seemed like a weird thing. Like back in Canada, sure, yeah, there's religious people who are telling you what to do, but you've come all the way to this monastery and you're going to say, oh no, I'm above religion.
Yeah.
Really?
It's also so funny that the religion you come from, you're like, I'm not doing that. But if some weird, like 2,000-year-old, well, that is Christianity, but you know, right. Some ancient thing, yeah, like, yeah. We have this thing you've never heard of, like, I'll do it. What do I have to do? What do I spray incense? Like, I'm down. But well, your own religion, you're like, fuck that. I'm out of that.
Totally. Now, you and I have talked this about in the context of Buddhism,
uh-huh.
Which is there's so many Judeo-Christian Buddhists in Southeast Asia where they go in and it's better than Christianity or Judaism, but they sort of have that same sort of rigid attitude toward it. Or they sort of have a hippy dippy. People screw up religion. Travelers screw up religion in so many ways.
Yeah.
And I like to think to be open-minded about it. But that was my point in Vagabond is that this woman wasn't being open-minded. She was being closed-minded. Like, sure, back in Alberta, religious people are overbearing, but you've come all this way. And these aren't Canadian Christians.
Yeah.
These are like Syrian Christians. And there's interfaith dialogue going on. And so really, you're going to refuse to go to the church service.
Okay, toilets were holes, I assume.
Toilets were holes.
Yeah.
There was no refrigerator. There's no electricity. So it was really cool. They had like a little screened-in cabinet. And so they would, when they would fix something that you would normally refrigerate, you don't save it for a week, but you may save it for a day. And it's behind a fly screen. And so it's room temperature, but it's behind a fly screen. So it does, so the insects don't get to it.
A thing on why flies are more disgusting than you think. Because you're like, oh, some flies, they're just eating my food. It's like, they're not. They're vomiting up like bile that like disintegrates it. And then if you screw them away, that bile still, it's like way grosser than just like a dog taking a bite out of your stuff.
Right, yeah. So I guess we have our refrigerated food
so
in the West.
So flies couldn't get on there. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Any hooking up there with these backpackers? It seems out of place to do that, but I'd assume also.
I was sort of non-sexual in Syria. It didn't really come to mind much. In the Islamic world in general, I wasn't really, even like with other backpackers, I wasn't really looking to hook up or anything. I'm sure there was some hooking up and I'm not sure how they like dealt with couples. I know that in other parts of the Islamic world, they were really nervous if you were a non-married couple staying in a hotel. And even once, it was in Cairo. I was staying in a hotel and a Norwegian backpacker friend wanted to hang out with me in my room. And the proprietor was really nervous because he thought we were going to have unmarital sex or something.
Yeah.
And so it's funny how in very religious cultures, they don't really understand. They think that because it's more sexually permissive in the West, that sex always happens all the time in the West.
Yeah,
and just, that Westerners are just like hot to trot constantly.
Yeah, it's like, no, we're just talking. We're just planning out our thing.
Yeah, but
also like could be right.
Could be right. But yeah, it was sort of an asexual situation for me. I wasn't, that wasn't what I had on the mind.
What'd you get food-wise here?
Lentils, homemade cheese, honey, pita. Yeah. Just great, fantastic Middle Eastern food.
Damn.
Olives.
They fed you, or you had to pay for it?
No, they fed us.
Wow.
And some of the volunteers helped cook, helped clean.
How long did you stay here for?
Probably just 3 or 4 nights.
Wow.
And one funny thing I learned is almost like a parable about what it's like to be in a place where backpackers are constantly churning through, or any travelers are constantly churning through. They put me in this little hut, near the goat pens, and a Saint Bernard had just given birth to puppies outside the thing, and she kept growling on me every time I would walk to the place where I was staying. I kept telling the monks, "You got to move the Saint Bernard because she's growling at me because her puppies are right there. Either move her and her puppies, or have them stay someplace." They're like, "Oh, it's okay," because I was sort of a ghost to them. Sure, I was there for a couple of days, but they knew her, the dog, much better than me.
Like, we're not moving our friend for you, you idiot.
Exactly, no.
You're just free.
They cared
here.
Way more for the Saint Bernard than me. And then one day the dog bit me, and I walk up to the main guy bleeding into my socks. It's like, I told you the dog would bit me, and now... And so then, actually, it wasn't until... if I would have written a story, it would have been the dog that made me human, because I was like a ghost until it bit me. And then it's like, oh yeah, sorry. And so they cleaned out my wound and they remembered my name after that. But that makes sense, because in a sense, it means a lot to you. It's like, it was probably the 3 most interesting days of my year that year, staying in this crazy monastery in the mountains above Damascus. But for them, I was just another dude, just another pasty dude that was shuttling through. And sort of speaking in superlatives, and they were probably just happy I didn't, sell my possessions and live in a cave next to the Swiss guy. But at the end of the day, giving hospitality, and monks, a lot of monastic writing talks about this, is that it's not easy to give hospitality. And there's this old joke where, God, says, he gives an edict that you must give hospitality to strangers, because think of it as the impersonization, as the embodiment of Jesus, like treat all guests as Christ. And one of these monks, he said to his superiors, like, oh, Jesus, is it you again? like another freaking Jesus is showing up.
Yeah, after a while, Jesus would be like, hey, dude, you're getting to my nerves now.
Exactly.
Thanks for dying for our sins, but you're milking it.
Yeah. And you read a lot of accounts, travel writing of pilgrims who traveled during that time, and they rave about the monks. I would love to read the monks back in the day. It's like, oh yeah, another bunch of rich Europeans coming through in the 12th century. We've got to feed them, and they're going to talk about how much they love Jesus and yada, yada, yada.
I went to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre a few years ago, and those guys, they're doing the chains with the incense, and there's all these tourists taking pictures, and they're so pissed. They're like, they want to say it. Get out of the fucking way.
Instead,
they just bash them with the incense thing,
and they're
just like, move.
Yeah.
Even though that's their only clothes, because those people are coming in and paying.
Yeah. Now, there's some serious grumpiness going on in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. That's an amazing place. not in Syria, but close. But
So you go there. Who'd you meet? Are these pictures from there, or are these pictures from another place?
Yeah, they're all mixed up. This is when I took a taxi. I was trying to take a taxi to the Tigris River, because I just wanted to look into Iraq. This was back when Iraq was really exotic. This was before the 2003 war. So I just wanted to look in this forbidden country. And so this dude, this was like an old Buick with suicide doors and like some sort of...
Or suicide ones go up?
The suicide doors are when the door handles are on the same side. So the back seat has the handle on the right and the front seat has on the left. And so you open it up. I don't know why they're called suicide doors. But it was like some like... And this was the beginning of this theory that like everybody in the world has a cousin in New Jersey.
Yeah.
Like I was driving across the wastelands. I was way up in the corner of Syria, and this guy is making conversation in his limited English, and he showed me a picture of like his cousin lived in New Jersey.
Really?
Yeah.
It's amazing how people get here.
Yeah. And it's not just New Jersey, but there's a lot of international people in New Jersey, the greater New York area. And so middle of nowhere, Syria, somehow this guy had family in New Jersey.
Damn.
And so, yeah, so that guy drove me to the Tigris River. It was sort of a non-event, but I took this is a selfie before selfie. That's a film camera selfie, a picture I took of myself.
Oh my God.
I have long arms.
You look so
fucking
young there.
Yeah.
Look at those kissable lips.
Right. I was still in my 20s. I was just barely in my 20s.
Damn, that's cool. You did all this alone, huh?
Yeah, I was solo the whole time. Yeah, so these are the Kurds that I met up in Qamishli.
I mean, if not for your smile, this is a hostage video.
These guys were amazing, though. This is the guy on the right is Khalid. I actually studied my notes before I came here. Okay. Khalid is like a banana vendor, and he's like, I can get you to Iraq. You want to go to Iraq? I'll take you to Iraq. And I'm like, really? And he's like, yes. And so the KDP, which is like the Kurdish political party, which has a stronger presence in Iraq, but also an office in Syria.
Yeah.
He like takes me to the office of the KDP in Qamishli. And he's like, this is my friend Rolf, and he wants to go to Iraq. Can we take him there? And like the guy behind the desk is like, Khalid, you're a banana vendor. And he didn't say this, but that was sort of the vibe I got. It's like, I think it's cool that you can take your American friend here, but I'm not going to take this dipshit into Iraq just because
not to come back
just because he's your friend.
Yeah, relax, but bro.
He's this cool guy. That's the guy. Khalid is he's the one who showed me the basketball of like the or the magazine of the basketball league in northern Iraq, in Kurdish Iraq.
Oh.
Where because of that flyover zone, it's almost like metaphorically, it's like the DMZ in Korea has all this wildlife because no people have been there for 50 years, more than 50 years. Like all the trees have grown back and all these crazy wildlife. Well, you have a no-fly zone over Iraq for 10 years and basketball leagues pop up.
No-fly zone. So what does that mean? You just couldn't...
Well, that meant that Saddam couldn't take heavy military expeditions into northern Iraq or else they'd get bombed by American Air Force. And so the no-fly zone just meant that, good luck trying to have a major military presence. Basically, it meant Americans were protecting the Kurds from Iraq when Saddam was still around. And because I guess we were trying to sort of normalize certain American ideas, they were promoting, I'm sure the State Department helped fund this magazine, but it was about basically the Kurdish YMCA and their basketball league. I wish I had a copy of this because I tell this story a lot.
Had to be all guards. You 5'11 must be a center there.
Actually, not really. I think Kurds, it's not like East Asia where people are shorter on average that, those guys are pretty short.
Yeah.
First of all,
sick jacket. On what's his name? Khalid?
Khalid, yeah. Yeah.
Super sick jacket. Also, banana, what is he? Banana what?
He sells bananas.
No, what'd you call him? Banana what?
Banana vendor?
Banana vendor.
Yeah.
Sounds sexual. Sounds like a fucking badass slayer.
If you're a porn star, it's on your business card, right?
Amateur banana vendor, professional fucking Walmart greeter. Damn, that's so cool. Do you have one of these candy bars?
I did. Maybe. I don't. The thing of it is that like the candy bars aren't the draw there. Like the food, like the strawberries or the bananas were okay, but like the fool and the falafel, that Middle Eastern food was amazing and dirt cheap.
What's super fool? Cheap.
Fool is like those big ass beans.
Uh-huh.
F-U-U-L, I think is how they transliterate it. But it's just like big, hearty Middle Eastern beans. And it's great for backpackers because it costs like 40 cents for a giant bowl of spicy beans. Whoa. I don't know what kind of garbanzo. I don't know what kind of beans they are.
Somali style fava beans. Somali.
Oh, is it fava beans?
Yeah.
And then what Hamel Lectern ate his victim with. It could be Ethiopian. I don't know. But they had fool. I ate fool all over the Arabic Middle East. And actually I had sheep's brain sandwiches.
No.
Yeah.
Really?
Have you had a sheep's brain sandwich before?
Not a sandwich. I had one cow brain one time at a place in LA on Fairfax.
Okay.
They had it. It was like, I think it was called Animal. But like, it's gooey. Not gooey, but like jiggly.
Yeah, it felt like, it sort of like was jello-y in my experience. That there was sort of no substance to the sheep's. And I only got it because it was a sheep's brain sandwich. Like I had all these options. It's like, I'm going to eat this sandwich so I have a story to tell.
Will you do that? Will you see a food and be like, I got to try this. Yeah. I'm not going to be back.
Yeah, no. I ate bundegi, which is silkworms, when I was in Korea. Or I ate boshintang, which is sort of a dog meat stew when I was in Korea.
Yeah.
I have to have the sheep's brain sandwich because now I can talk about the sheep's brain sandwich that I ate in Damascus. There's also I had a strawberry smoothie. Like the fruit was really good. Oh my God, my mouth is watering. So I'm sure those candy bars are fine, but The food was amazing.
It looks good. The Aleppo sandwich, for the flavors of the.
And actually, this is something I found in other parts of the world. Poor countries, countries that don't have a lot of industrial output, oftentimes have great food. Like my sister went to Moldova, which is close to your ancestral homeland, and she said the salads were amazing. Like the salads and soups in Moldova were just lights out.
I was talking to my mom about this. My dad just got his Romanian passport.
No kidding.
After maybe 5 years of trying. A lot of that, the COVID, like he was close and they were like,
is that get EU? Your...
It is.
So you can get an EU passport.
So I put it in his mind because I'm like, hey, I found out they have a right to return for any child.
Nice.
I'm like,
nice,
Dad,
nice.
You got help me out here.
Yeah, man.
It opens up everything for me. He just got it. But I was talking to my mom about it. She goes, Romanian food is terrible. Nobody talks about it. I'm like, it's just not known.
Yeah.
There's great food.
Yeah.
It's just not known. And if this stuff, it's like, it's just what's known and what's like unknown, but still awesome.
Yeah. No, Syria had great fruit. And not all the fruit.
Fried sheep's brain.
Oh, is that fried sheep's brain?
Yeah. Was it fried when you had it or was it some other way?
No. I think maybe it was boiled.
Ugh.
But it sort of looked like it's been 24 years ago, Ari. I'm not
okay.
Like, I remember the presence of I know the fact that I ate it more than the actual experience of it. It's like I was almost writing it down in my journal as I was eating it because I was just so excited to be eating. That's what it looks like. That's what it looked like.
That looks like it.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
Was it good? Do you remember?
It was okay. It didn't make me crave sheep's brain sandwiches, but. It was dirt cheap.
You seem honest enough too, where it's like, okay, so you're gonna have some weird thing, like I'll never get this again. Gotta try it.
Right.
You seem honest enough to go, this was fucking wild. I loved it. This was like, eh.
Yeah.
And this was one of those. We're like, it's fine.
This was fine.
Yeah.
It wasn't disgusting and it wasn't particularly good. Like when I was in Thailand, not to keep bouncing all over the place, but I had like some fried grasshoppers. But I think they'd been cooked in like chicken fat or something. They were delicious. It was like eating chicken skin. And then I got some crickets, and it was like, these are disgusting. So you just never know. When you're eating weird food, you never know what's going to be good. Sheep's brain is maybe a C-. It was fine.
Damn. Okay. Cool. What else did you get into?
In food-wise or just...
Just overall. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, if there's more food you want to tell me about, otherwise...
Like... We're getting a little unchronological here. One reason why Con Air, I will always have a place in my heart for the movie Con Air, is that I took the jet bus from... It's J-E-T-T, it's Jordanian something, from Amman, Jordan to Damascus, Syria. It was like a $5 bus, air conditioning, and they play movies. And they played Con Air. I'd never seen it before. Have you seen Con Air?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah. It's like, as if you take every action movie that was ever made and it creates an algorithm that just creates cliche after cliche. It's a delightful movie.
It really is. Even the Steve Buscemi, who's the most unsettling character.
He's like the Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, he does stuff to children.
Right.
There was just a girl like, oh, please don't. And then it's like, okay, she didn't get it. It's okay. We didn't do that.
Yeah. No, you almost expect him to be Hannibal Lecter, but like he's the voice of reason in that movie. He like actually says, makes some decent observations in that movie. But what was so delightful is that there's an ironic level at which you can see Con Air. And so I was laughing.
Yeah.
And everybody in this, all the Syrians in the bus, they were watching it translated and they were just watching an action movie. They weren't jaded. They weren't like jaded hipsters sort of making fun of it. Whereas I was laughing because it is a funny movie. Yeah. I mean, it's actually a delightful movie, but.
It's funny. I saw when it came out and I was like, sick. And then like all those movies, like 8 years later, like, this is ridiculous.
It's totally ridiculous.
Yeah. He's landing on the strip in Vegas.
It's so enjoyable.
Yeah.
And the fact that I was laughing and the Syrians were turning and looking like, okay, not sure why he's laughing.
They
were sort of rooting for the Nick Cage character. And then pretty soon they're like handing me their babies and giving me food. Like I was Mr. Personality. Like I was having so much fun with this movie that to this day, Con Air, the movie, reminds me of taking the bus to Damascus. And so that was my entree, is that basically I met like 30 Syrians because I thought Con Air was hilarious. And they were cheering. Like they were at the end of the movie when Nick Cage lands a plane on the Vegas Strip and and Steve Buscemi gets away or whatever. They were so excited. They were into
Whoa.
It.
Whoa. I love that they play movies on these buses. God.
Yeah.
And it's just like it harkens back to the planes when it was like the movie will start in 45 minutes.
Yeah.
The movie.
Yeah.
Not like your choice of movies.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, you better be on this.
Have you ever seen a movie in a weird place and you sort of remember a place because of the movie?
Yeah. When I got to Myanmar, where I got this hat. Where I first read your book.
Nice.
I might have been wearing this hat.
Nice.
We went to see I forgot the name of it, but it was based on a video game, and it was like Knights of the Templar, and this guy was like scaling walls and stuff. God damn, I wish I knew. But yeah, we went to see it, and it was like, it's burning my mind. They serve kettle corn popcorn instead of regular popcorn. Yeah. Everyone's talking. It's a date night because it's air conditioning. Yeah. It's the only place with air conditioning.
Yeah.
People were sleeping in there, and it wasn't like weird.
Yeah.
It was such a nothing movie that I can't remember it, but I will always associate it with that place.
It's funny, everybody was talking because you forget that these movies, people are watching them on the subtitles. I watched Titanic in the Philippines.
Wow.
And there was people, like, there was a woman reading, she probably knew English, but she was like reading the Tagalog subtitles, but like explaining the subtitles to her grandma in her tribal language. And so for half the movie, I'm like, would you shut up? Like, I'm thinking in my mind, would you shut up? And in fact, it was like this family experience where she's like helping grandma understand things. Actually, I saw, not to get off on a tangent, but when I was hitchhiking across Eastern Europe, I saw some art movie in like Budapest. And my Hungarian friends were translating, who I'd met that day, were trying to translate the movie for me as it was going. And so I was sort of the other Hungarians in the cinema are like, we can read the subtitles. Why are you talking? Well, they were reading the Hungarian subtitles to the American. And it's fun. It's fun how communal movies can be. Like movie cinemas can be kind of cool communal places.
Yeah.
But this wasn't even a cinema, it was a bus. And so to this day, I'll always think of Syria when I watch Con Air.
I love the idea of them cheering, like really getting into it.
Yeah, no, I think there was this sort of guilelessness that there's probably fewer entertainments in Syria in general, but they were just excited. They were watching, it was like an old-fashioned, it was like watching a movie when the sound came around in the 1930s. They were just into it.
Wow.
They were all in.
Were there black people in Syria?
Oh, this is another thing. This is actually really interesting. I was walking through like the Christian quarter of Damascus and heard gospel music, like American gospel music. These aren't Americans. They're Syrian refugees. And so I walk into this church and it's like, I felt homesick because it reminded me of, you know, the gospel music I would hear sometimes when I was growing up.
Syrian refugees where?
In Damascus. So the Syrian civil war was going on. This is before Sudan. Sudanese.
Okay.
South Sudan hadn't broken off yet. And so Black Sudan was fighting against Arab Sudan. And the refugees, Syria took in all these refugees.
Oh.
And so on the street.
Wow. And now we won't take their refugees.
Yeah. No, it's crazy that literally on the street, I would go uphill and I would hang out in a cafe with the Syrian Muslims. I would go down the street and hang out with my Syrian Christian friends. I think a lot of these people resettled in Canada. And
I mean,
it was amazing. These people are amazing travelers that basically they spoke multiple languages. They'd been living between places for years. They didn't know where they're going to live the next day. This guy was clearly a Yankees fan.
Clearly a Yankee fan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those infants are now, you know, in their mid 20s probably now.
Wow.
And you know, as a good Christian or Muslim culture, these happen to be Christian, they were very hospitable. Well, they thought it was weird that an American wandered into their church service.
How did they get into gospel music?
That's a good question. Maybe because, well, Christianity is sort of a global religion.
Yeah.
And so maybe missionaries, or maybe there's a big American influence on
Could
them.
Could be. I mean, the message is lovely. In gospel music,
yeah,
you know, so it's like that translates to whatever you like, Jesus.
Well, and gospel music was very heavily African American, so I'm not sure if they identify with like sort of the African American side of American Christianity. But I saw there was a hymnal that had a hymn called "I Get So Thrilled with Jesus," and it's like that's got to be a gospel song. Like, what kind of old German person is going to write a song called "I Get So Thrilled with Jesus"? And so, literally, I felt homesick hearing gospel songs. And so, I walked into this. This is a great thing about not having too rigid of a plan. It's like I was walking through the Christian quarter of Damascus. I heard a gospel song, and it's like whatever I was going to do, I'm not going to do anymore. I'm going to go in and see what's going on in this church service.
Yeah, I guess talk about that for a second. This is not like your travel exactly, but like an overall like idea of travel of changing plans at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, yeah.
You're great at it. Of just like, oh, new plan.
Yeah, some days better than others.
Sure. Okay, I mean, that's fair.
It's easier to preach it than to live it. You know, because sometimes you really do want to get the things on your checklist.
Yeah.
But I was wandering through the city and I was also really involved. I was still writing my travel column for salon.com. This is before vagabonding. And so I was sort of looking for stories. And so maybe there's an extent to which it's like, well, the worst that can happen is I have an interesting story to tell.
That's nice, actually, for a way to get you moving.
Yeah.
It's like, this could be a story. Totally. I mean, comics do that. Like, it's going to suck. Like, it turned into a bit. If it sucks, it'll be a bit. And you're like, all right, I guess it's at least, like, creatively tax deductible.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Totally. And I think that's both something we have in our toolkits as travelers, is that at the very least, we have a story that will result in it. That's why I tried to buy a donkey in Egypt, that, and that was in Marco Polo Didn't Go There, my second book. But I never did write about this, but this is the service they had.
Wow.
And they shared it with like a Greek Orthodox church. So like there's only so many, like the local Christians shared their church with the refugee Christians, even though they were a different sect. So these are probably Protestants. And it was like a Greek Orthodox church, but they had some band music, and it was really interesting. And I often say that these guys put most American travelers to shame, not because they've been on the best beaches or fly in jets, but because they've been wandering the earth as refugees by this point for multiple years.
There's refugees in my neighborhood now. They showed up in October, a line around the block of dark, just like these guys, dark black people. I thought it was a casting call.
Oh, no
kidding. They're just like a line. It was like,
they do you know where they're from? Are they from Sudan or?
Mauritania.
Oh,
some.
Interesting.
It took a while, and I'm like, wait, they're here every day. And now they're actually being processed. They're refugees.
Right.
And now the area is kind of like split on the neighborhood. It's like, well, who are these people? Are these like homeless? And it's like, no, they're not homeless. And if you talk to, they don't all speak English, but if you talk to any of them, it's like what you're saying, like, no, they're like, I fled. I was going to get arrested in the middle of the night. I fled because I was trying to topple my government. These aren't guys that are like, I'm just poor.
Right.
You know, I'm not a drug addict. But it's like, they have stories to tell. I'm trying to get to talk to them slowly.
Yeah.
You know?
No, and then they're travelers like us, but 10 times as much. I mean, obviously they haven't gone to as many places, but they've had to hustle. They've had to make...
They never crossed a river in the middle of the night to get over a land, border.
Seriously. Yeah, it's hardcore. That's the only picture I have from the monastery. Isn't that crazy?
Wow.
Those are the old frescoes. That's the old hundreds of years old. This is like the Kurds in Qamishli let me stay at their house. A guy named Majid, he had like 8 kids. He's like, Saddam Hussein killed 200,000 Kurds, and so I've had 8 kids. I'm trying to repopulate. Anyway, again, hospitality in the Muslim world. They fed me their best lentils. I stayed in a guest room. Crazy thing is that I didn't meet any of the female members of the family. I was in their house, but by the Muslim strictures, I was not a family member. I think maybe they came in. I saw them when they were bringing food in, but I didn't really interact with the women. So it was very traditional yet very friendly. And it was sort of a blessing for them. Like they don't get a chance to meet, obviously, very many Americans. And so I was sort of this goofball who slept on their floor for a night.
Wow. Yeah, Zane had that story about like meeting one of the daughters and realizing, he's like, oh shit, they have intentions.
They have what?
Intentions for
me. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay, right, yeah. Well, Zane, our friend Zane is part Syrian. His mom is Syrian.
Yeah, that's right, right.
It's multicultural in a way. It's just the crossroads of the world. People have been coming through. In fact, you read travel writers, Ibn Battuta, the great, the Marco Polo of the Arab world in the 13th century, he mentions Damascus, and he mentioned it's either him or Benjamin of Tudela, the Jewish Marco Polo. There's like 3,000 Jews in Damascus when he was there. So it's always been a multicultural city. It's always been the crossroads of several continents, of 3 continents.
Yeah, they always said like there's like a misconception about like Iran, where they're like, they hate Jews. And it's like, they kind of more hate Zionists, but there's tons of Jews who live peacefully there. I don't know if it's still, but to a recent past, they were like, yeah, as long as you're not like into taking over like that one city.
Yeah,
we love you. You're fine.
Sephardic folks.
Uh-huh.
That's more 20th century geopolitics, actually, just what happened to the Jewish communities in all of these parts of the world. And in Qamishli, in that city where we were talking about the NBA, some guys at the table claimed there were Jews in Qamishli. I never met them, but there were Christians. There were several sects of Christians and different kinds of Muslims hanging out with me.
They claimed that they were Jews, or that there were Jews?
They claimed there were Jews in this little town on the border of Turkey and Syria. So
the ones with the glasses.
Right.
The bald ones with the glasses. It's like, it's probably them. Do you ever feel bad staying in a place like this and like eating their food as like a rich American, even though you're a backpacker?
Oh, this happens everywhere in the world, that it's easy to feel guilty because you could afford 100 times this, you know?
Yeah.
But especially in cultures that value hospitality, it's a blessing for them, you know, that it gives them a chance to honor God, but then also to show largesse to people who are much richer than them.
Right.
I think I might talk about that in the Vagabonds way too, not in the context of Syria, but just like, yeah, it's so many parts of the world, hospitality is just what you do. And it's actually ruder to try and turn it down than to just simply accept it.
Yeah, or be like, let me give $5 to this. And it's like, what the fuck, man?
Yeah.
I'm offering you if I hold the door open for you, it's like, here's a dollar. I'm like, I'm not a fucking doorman.
Yeah, we've forgotten how it works. Yeah. We've forgotten how hospitality is just something that you accept, you eat your food, you make conversation.
In Ecuador, I saw a fight because an American was like, I got this round. And he was like, you think you're richer than me? You think I can afford a beer? And it's like, no, we just... What do you mean? We just cover rounds once in a while.
This happens when I was hitchhiking with the Hungarians in Eastern Europe. I ran in and I filled their tank of gas, and the driver's like, what the fuck? He was literally mad. It was insulting to him. In retrospect, I can maybe see why maybe there was something paternalistic.
And it's like, if you had done a deed, it probably would have been better. If you were like, let me take the squeegee and wipe the whatever, maybe that'd be like, oh, that's nice of you.
But it's like I almost had this American guilt. I don't know what it was, but it's like, I'm going to do these guys a favor. I'm going to grab this round of gas. And this guy was having none of it.
Plus, back then, you're like, I wish I couldn't really afford it. I'm glad I'm pissed to have done it.
It's actually a huge mistake. Part of my budget. Yeah.
What else did you want to tell me about Syria? I don't want to like guide you too much. I know you probably have some stories to tell me. Who are these? Is this that same place?
That's Majid, who has the 8 kids. Damn. I hope these people are okay. I mean, Syria hasn't been a very friendly place to be for the last 10 or 15 years. I talked about the smugglers. There's so much you can talk about. I talked about Con Air. Let me see what my cheat sheet
says. This is something I want to talk about. This chair that is in every poor country.
Yeah.
It is a child's... Yeah. It takes the place of a table, a chair. It's in every outdoor like seating area in Thailand, China, Myanmar, everywhere. It's this plastic chair.
Yeah.
How does that get everywhere?
That's a travel book right there.
Like, yeah, that
be
chair.
The person who travels, you know.
Just to find that
follows
chair.
That chair around the world. Yeah, there is a sameness. Even like certain cinder block buildings, you know, certain warm parts of the world, there's a sameness to in developing worlds. Yeah, so there I am with a couple of Iraqi taxi drivers or guys who did business with Iraq.
What are you drinking, tea?
Drinking tea, yeah.
What's the tea culture there like in Syria?
Well, actually, the coffee culture is amazing. The tea culture, I'm more of a coffee guy, but I just remember, in fact, I wrote it in my journal, having like Arabic coffee with cardamom in Damascus and feeling super high. Like it's like a cool morning in the Middle East and you get your caffeine buzz. And I would write like, about someday I'm going to look back on this moment. Well, now it is someday and I'm looking back on that moment and there's something really thrilling about sort of having a caffeine high in a new place and just sort of looking around and thinking, I am here and this is amazing. I think sometimes you don't need an intoxicant or some sort of upper or downer to remind you of this, but sometimes it's sort of nice. You know, maybe you take the shot of ouzo or you have a really strong cup of Turkish coffee that's just rich with sugar and cardamom. And then it's morning and you're sort of starting to wake up and you realize you know nothing. You have no idea you're going to eat a sheep's brain sandwich. You know, you have no idea the next car that drives down the street is going to have a Batman symbol on it. And it's just, those are the simple, and you can appreciate this, those are the simple moments that make travel worth it. There's the bucket list, but then there's also those moments where it's just like, I am nobody knows where I am.
Yeah.
And I am wide awake and anything could happen. And I just feel so lucky.
Yeah. You're drinking some coffee. Right. Exactly. You're like, and the tastes are so full because you're like, this is different. I'm noticing it as you're noticing everything else around you.
Yeah.
You're right. Nobody knows who I am. That's a good way to put it too, because it's like,
or where I am.
It makes it more exciting.
Yeah, it's that, and I think this happens less often now because we live through our phones, but just like anything could happen. Nobody knows I'm here. Nobody knows who I am. I'm going to walk down the street and it's going to be super interesting. And it is.
Yeah. You know? God damn. How long did you stay in Syria for?
3 weeks.
3 weeks.
Yeah.
Was that the, is it like a month long visa? Do you remember?
I don't remember. I honestly don't remember.
A lot of these places are 30 days.
Yeah.
It's like the standard.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's probably what it was. And I had to apply for it in Egypt. And then it was sort of an out and back thing. Went back to Jordan. But it's easy to say because now it's sort of an off limits country. It's just one of my favorite places just because I guess, and this is any place that has a bad reputation probably has super friendly people because they're just not jaded by tourists. And people don't see you in a geopolitical way. You know, it's just like, oh, you don't see this guy every day.
Right.
Who in this neighborhood knows English? Let's get that kid who's been studying English and let's find out what this guy wants.
Yeah.
And that really happened in Syria. And I don't know, it's like the Syrians I met were really educated too. It was a dictatorship, but they had good education, just a lot of engineers. I mean, it's that sort of old Ba'athist idea of, I don't know, Soviet self-improvement or something, but... And maybe there's a little bit of 2020 hindsight, but I just have really fond memories of Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And when all that violence broke out in the early 2010s, I was really sad because I met some really cool people there.
Was Damascus a cultural center? Like the way they said Beirut before all that was like the cultural hub of the Middle East.
Yeah, and Egypt too. Like even like the you hear a call to prayer in Indonesia, and odds are it was recorded in Egypt. You know that like that.
Really?
There's a huge population density there. Beirut, definitely, because Beirut is practically Europe, right?
Yeah.
Very, very global. Cairo is less so, but Cairo is it's the pop culture center of the Middle East. Damascus, there is some. Like you read an anthology of Arabic writing, there'll be a few Syrians, Damascus-based people there.
Did you get to Aleppo?
I did.
This was kind of destroyed, right?
That was destroyed. I bought some silks in that market that was destroyed in the war.
Oh.
I wrote a story about it. Yeah. I was like walking down the street, and this was before, it's so weird. Like 24 years ago, there weren't iPods, right? Some people traveled with some cassette tapes and a Walkman, right? I heard Sex Machine coming out of the hotel room where I was, and I had missed music so much, like the James Brown song, Sex Machine.
Oh,
I missed
yeah.
music so much that I just stood outside the room and listened to it. Like I was so hungry for songs. Like I remember watching Fight Club in Cairo and they play a Pixies song at the end, Where Is My Mind? And I just felt
good song.
Just, like you don't feel this
song.
Way anymore because you can listen to a library of music on your phone at any time. My heart was so full when I heard the Pixies at the end of Fight Club because I hadn't heard that music in a long time. I stood in the hall like some kind of pervert outside of somebody's Aleppo hotel room because I heard a James Brown song in Aleppo.
So funny, just like listening in.
Yeah, no, like I was like, it was like, I feel so good.
Yeah.
I felt so American. It was like the Star Spangled Banner times 100. It's like, I'm just so proud that James Brown is from America. And I'm just going to stand here until this song ends.
Yeah.
And the kids out there don't understand because it was great to immerse myself in the Arabic music. And there's some crazy stuff. I bought some Arabic cassette tapes in various parts of the world, including Syria. But the fact that I hadn't, you and I have talked about going to Israel after being in the Arab world. And then you see a woman in a bikini and it's like going through puberty again.
Because
you haven't been exposed to that. It's the same with music. Is like I hadn't heard any of the rock music that I loved, and so suddenly, or the soul music. So suddenly, I'm listening to James Brown, and I'm feeling as patriotic as I've ever felt, just because I hear it in Aleppo hotel room, in the hotel hallway.
Yeah.
And then she's like, I hope these guys don't open the door, but in a way, I don't care because I haven't heard this song in a while.
You'd be like, I know this song. I'm just listening.
Yeah.
Like you're not doing anything creepy. You're just like, it looks weird, but this is it. This was like where you went to get in Aleppo.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think of, I got some very, like, Arabic merchants are so, like, you talk to one guy and you buy something from him and he'll nod to the other guys down the way. And pretty soon everybody is trying to hustle you in because you're seen as a guy who wants to spend some money.
It's crazy. You're like, when they, like, you get a suit in, like, Hong Kong or something like that and you're walking out with your suit, they got to tell them, like, you want a suit? I'm like, no, I mean, I just got a suit.
Right.
Like, come on, get another suit.
Yeah.
I'm full.
No, when I was
suits.
In Thailand last December, I got a suit. It's an amazing suit.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I got some silks. I got some, like, some Syrian silks. That I gave, I think, my mom and my sister, and they were amazing. And that place is gone. It's a shame.
Damn. Yeah, war sucks. I heard one time, it just reminded me, and by the way, I've said this, and it's such a good writing tool that we figured out at the like Luxembourg Gardens.
Okay.
We're like, tell a story, remind me of a story, tell that story, remind me of a story, tell a story.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, we should do a podcast that way.
Yeah.
It's already okay. happened because like we've talked about Thailand and South America. Yeah.
I was landing, I was trying to go to East Timor, to land in West Timor or whatever in Indonesia.
In Indonesia, yeah.
And from the airport, got a cab to the one hostel I heard about. And a Guns N' Roses song came on. I was like, oh, sick.
Yeah.
In the cab. And then that ended, and it was like a 30-minute drive. A second Guns N' Roses song came on. I'm like, oh, this is the tape. You're playing the tape. Or they're playing it on the radio.
Right.
And I was like, take the long way. This is just fucking rules. Yeah. It just takes you back. You haven't heard that shit. It makes it so much richer.
Yeah. And you don't know what you're missing when you have a whole media library on your phone. And I'm not complaining, but I sort of am.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Because the beauty of listening to James Brown in a hallway in Aleppo, it was a way that I could only feel in the year 2000.
Yeah.
The beauty of watching Fight Club in Cairo, which is amazing in and of itself, because that's such a crazy movie, seeing it for the first time, and then hearing the Pixies at the end, and it's just like, yeah, that just felt so good. It's like meeting a part of yourself where you didn't expect to meet it. You know?
How do they take that movie in Cairo?
That's a great question.
I mean, it's all about overthrowing governments and the society
right,
in general.
Right, yeah.
I mean, when everything's blowing up at the end, spoiler, when everything's blowing up, you had your time.
Right.
It's just like, oh yeah, and the happy ending of the world just being destroyed is like, yeah, I wonder how they took that.
I wish I remembered how they took that. And maybe there weren't that many people in the theater and maybe it only ran for a week or two. I actually saw The Green Mile in Cairo.
Uh-huh.
Remember that movie?
Yeah.
And like every time the actor mentioned God, some pious guy in the audience was like, "Hala!" He was like really mad. They had sort of this new age science fiction Stephen King take on God. And so some pious guy in his jalaba was like, he was reminding everybody in the theater that we're not going to have this Americanized, you know, Stephen King prison idea of God, but he's going to remind us.
I like how they rename movies in other countries because it doesn't apply. I saw Groundhog Day in Israel, and they just don't have that holiday.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it was called "I'll See You Again Tomorrow."
Okay.
In Hebrew.
Oh, that's not bad.
That's not bad. It's pretty close. Yeah.
That could almost be its own UB Tripping episode. It's like movies you've seen in other places.
That's a good idea.
Pleasantville.
Ideas from new episodes. There we go.
Seriously. Yeah. No, it's affecting. Yeah, I saw Pleasantville in Riga.
Where's Riga?
I saw Dude, Where's My Car in Bombay. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Where would they get any of that?
I don't know why they were showing Dude, Where's My Car.
I love a cadence movie translated. It's like, you're never going to get this.
Yeah. Yeah, I have no idea. I laughed until I cried.
Yeah.
Again, it was in that era. It was the same year. It was 2000. It was in that same year where it was like a heroin injection of American culture. And like all the references in Dude, Where's My Car? I have to rewatch that movie. It's a very silly movie, but
Yeah.
But I watched it in Bombay, and it made me so happy.
Damn. I fucking want to go out to Syria now. No way. Can I get there?
Man.
You think it's safe?
Probably not. Kids out there, don't try it unless you like have a family member there.
I met a Swiss lady who was going to Iran. She's like a environmental activist now. But I was like, Iran? She goes, I mean, you got to wear a scarf some places. But she's like, those dangerous parts are like 3 out of 40.
Right.
So like, it's not that bad.
I bet Iran is really friendly too. I bet you meet, again, another Islamic right. country that doesn't get a lot of Western tourists. Not a lot of Americans. But again, everybody has a cousin in America,
right.
in Iran. Because there's so many Persians in the U.S. that I would love to go there.
Yeah, you rape people for their governments, and then the people have nothing to do with that.
Not at all.
I mean, a quarter of this country voted for Trump. A quarter of this country voted for Biden. So like 75% of us are not that government.
Well, I've said before that the people most likely to judge me as an American on the other side of the world are Canadians and Brits.
Right.
You know, because they have a very strong sense. They sort of define themselves in contrast to the U.S. Like, well, at the very least, there's an American there, and they've done more embarrassing things geopolitically than we have.
Right.
But at the end of the day, oh my God, like my taxi driver in Syria was so excited, you know, that he had an American in his cab. And that's all over the world.
It's NBA. I had one in somewhere, maybe Myanmar, maybe somewhere. I was like, they're from America. They're like, Schwarzenegger. And I'm like, oh, wow. Yeah, he's not American, by the way, but okay, I get what you're saying.
Right.
It's like movies is what you mean.
Well, I'm not surprised that they were into Schwarzenegger. I was surprised that they were literate in the Utah Jazz. Specifically,
wow.
They were talking about, this guy was a Utah Jazz fan in Qamishli, Syria in the year 2000.
Wow.
And I just thought that was cool. Because at the end of the day, that's what people care about. You know, they like, do we know who other countries' leaders are or what their foreign policies are or even what their histories are?
They were a bad team back then. Damn. Oh, wait, that's now.
Okay.
Go back.
Okay.
They don't go back.
No, I think they're pretty
good. Okay, here we go. The Jazz got off to a 15-7 start. Not bad. 55-27. Damn, that's pretty good.
That's a good team. Yeah,
division,
that's what they were
first,
talking about,
Midwest.
The Jazz.
Yeah.
And then also Majid, the guy with the 8 kids, he's like, Magic Johnson is dead. And I'm like, no. He got AIDS, but he hasn't died. He's like, no.
He's dead.
No, you don't know this, but he's dead. And so like, I was sort of in an argument with the Syrian guy who was just convinced. It's like, you couldn't convince him that Magic Johnson was not dead.
25 years later, he's still alive.
Right?
Like, no, he died.
Exactly. So Majid in Qamishli, Syria, 24 years ago, is like, no. You didn't know? Like, Magic Johnson is dead. It's like,
he's trying to break the news to you.
He had AIDS. Reader's Digest, Batman, Magic Johnson, the Utah Jazz.
Majid rules, first of all.
Yeah. I think that's Majid.
Yeah.
I think that's Majid and maybe his wife or his mom or something.
Careful, you're going to insult him if it's, right. if it's his wife.
Right. I should have taken more pictures. That's the crazy thing. You have roll of film, and you know, it's expensive to your dirtbag sensibility, and the pictures don't come out that well anyway. And it's months before you can see what they look like.
Yeah.
And so I gave you all my Syria pictures. How many of them? Like 8 or 9?
7, 8. Yeah, something like that. The weird thing with pictures is you have to stop and interrupt the day to do it. But so it's like, I have a memory right now. I don't need this right now. You know, this memory of this, you will, I mean, 25 years later.
Yeah.
Yeah, you weren't going to remember the tapestry on his wall.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. James Brown moved my soul, and that was a technologically rich moment because I didn't have any other options. But at the same time, I have fucking 8 pictures of Syria. You know, James Brown, I hadn't heard James Brown in so long that it made me feel patriotic, yet... This is like my third best picture from Syria, and it's a pretty awful picture.
Where'd you get that jacket?
That's a Patagonia.
Oh, really?
I worked at an outdoor store in Kansas when I was in my early 20s. I still have that thing.
You do?
It sort of makes me look like a character from Monsters.
No way. You have that jacket?
Oh, I still have that jacket, yeah. I have a lot of clothes. You're not that way. I have a lot of clothes that I've had. I mean—
No. I live in a closet. You live on a farm.
Oh, right.
So you have way more ability to store things.
That's true. That's true.
Wow, you still have that fucking jacket.
I don't wear it a lot. But
I'm
a
materialist, so like, I love that.
Yeah.
You know, that's amazing.
Actually, I could write the story of, I still have the shoes that I wore on that trip because I have a sentimental relationship to them.
Yeah.
And so I could write a history in clothes. I wrote a book about souvenirs. You've read that book.
Yeah, small,
but
easy read.
Clothes are a weird, like, signifier of certain times in your life, you know? So I've lived that coat, just like that copy of The Vagabond's Way has been to more countries than some Americans. That coat has been all over the place, you know?
Yeah.
And it's possible I'm wearing that on the cover of Vagabonding. It was the same trip, same year I took the picture on the cover of Vagabonding.
No.
No?
You're wearing a white shirt.
Oh, no, I'm wearing that shirt. I'm wearing that. And
really?
That's like a... Yeah, I think that's like a North Face vintage shirt.
Hold on, I can look it up here instead of... that's Egypt?
Yeah, no. That's the shirt. I have those boots in my closet. Those are the
same
pants.
No fucking way, really?
Yeah. Yeah, those boots. In fact, if
anybody... What kind of boots are they?
I should auction those off for charity. They're Oslo. A-S-O-L-O.
There's a bunch of people who have gone on to... better financial things than when they needed to read this book.
Right.
Who would pay some money for charity?
Would someone like to buy those boots for charity? I have them. I don't wear them. So.
Wow.
Yeah, actually,
What backpack were you using there?
That's an Eastern Mountain Outfitters. I worked in an outdoor store when I was 20, after my first vagabond trip with the van. So I was 24, 25. I was selling outdoor gear for a living, and I really got the job so I could get a pro deal, a discounted outdoor clothing. I still own a lot of the gear, including sleeping bags that I got during that time.
You go to REI ever?
Oh, you were asking. What? I think it's EMS. Yeah, my wife loves REI, but that's EMS. And so that's
the backpack?
Yeah. It's way too big. Zane, our friend, gave me shit about that because it's like, dude, why are you carrying that much shit?
Through the desert too, by the way. Right. It's like jettison some things.
No, there's a sleeping bag in there. Like this was when I was still a little bit naive. I was still a little bit green. And so I carried a sleeping bag all over the Middle East and I only slept in it like 7 times.
When I went to Ecuador, it was like, hey, we might need to go camping. Let's bring like tents and stuff. Yeah. And then it hit me like, am I going to travel around for months with a maybe? Or they probably have, it's a major city. I can get a sleeping bag there.
Totally.
If I need it. Never did.
Went to Kenya last summer, climbed Mount Kenya, bought a backpack in France, rented hiking poles, rented a sleeping bag. It's so much better to just rent.
I met a friend in Guatemala, a hiker. A real hiker, he's an Australian, and he said all these people go Chimborazo and try to climb it, but it's all these rich people, and they're done. They're like, I don't want this stuff anymore.
Oh.
And he goes, I want to start a business just getting that stuff and then renting it to people.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's so many, I'm sure this happens more in Kilimanjaro. I climbed Mount Kenya last year. It was my pen cap. Where people come with a very specific idea of what it's going to be like. When in fact, just show up and somebody will rent you your gear and you hire porters to carry your stuff. You don't need that much stuff anyway in that type of situation. But this, I was so green. I slept in the desert that night.
Wow.
This is actually my story from Marco Polo Didn't Go There, Be Your Own Donkey. So when I tried to buy a donkey and nobody would sell one to me, so I just, they said, be your own donkey, asshole. Go walk in the desert. You don't need a donkey. So I had this adventure in the desert, way, way overpacked.
What a cool picture.
Yeah, that's EMS, I think it's like Eastern Mountain, something or another. I got it on a pro deal. I still have that bag. I may give it to my nephew.
Damn, bro.
But yeah, it's funny. I have an old Gregory pack that I used in the 1980s. And a buddy of mine he flips stuff on eBay. And it's worth like $300 to $500. Like this old,
really
banged up. Because there's people who are really into Gregory backpacks, which is sort of an elite brand. It's like an OG Spire backpack.
My Osprey just started breaking.
Yeah.
That I had through Asia, through everywhere. And then they're like, they will fix it. And if they can't fix it, they'll schedule a new one. But it's like 8 weeks. And I'm like, well, I gotta.
Have they sponsored yet, Osprey?
No, what the fuck? It's my favorite backpack.
You've given them free advertising
again,
yeah.
But I gotta get a new one. And it's like, then you gotta like decide like what, you gotta get the exact right leader so you can fit it on overheads. They made it like a slightly bigger model of the one I have. And I'm like, no, that's not gonna work anymore. I was at the limit right then.
I use Tortuga. I know the guy who started Tortuga, and it's actually designed for travelers. So many Europeans you see, and again, this is free advertising, but I love Tortuga.
Yeah, sure.
Like you see these Germans and they're like hike the Alps backpacks and they're in Sri Lanka. Whereas Tortuga, it's made for travelers. And so you fit it in the overhead bin.
Right.
It's 30 or 40 liters. It's designed not for camping in the woods, but for traveling the world. And so it's nice.
There's a different one for woods backpacking. That's a different thing.
Yeah,
for hiking that where you need granola bar pouches.
Totally.
That you can
or your canteens or your hiking poles or whatever. And when you travel, when you go to Syria or Thailand or whatever, you don't need that much. And so just have a nice cube that you can put in the airplane that isn't going to be heavy. That's not.
We should design a backpack. Because at least they should ask you. They'd be like, what do you want? I want a top loading and bottom loading possible. Yeah, yeah. So you don't have to like unload everything to get some or total unzip so you can like see everything. Detachable day pack is huge.
Okay.
Some of those straps to like hang stuff on, like wet socks. What would you put on there?
And it's been a while since I've been super dirtbag backpacking. Yeah. So they should do several different levels. And by the way, Osprey, you guys should sponsor him. If not, we can talk to Tortuga because I know that Tortuga, Fred is the founder of Tortuga. He can design the Ari Shaffir, maybe.
Really?
Backpack.
Yeah,
maybe.
Covered up like a Maryland flag.
I can talk to him about it.
Yeah.
Right? No, but totally. Like, you, how many times have you hand washed your clothes in the sink and they're not dry yet?
And you got to go.
Like a little rack, you can hang your socks on the back. Yeah, we'll have to think about this. Take notes. Next time you're out on the road, think what could be better about my pack right now?
Yeah, right, exactly. You need a Camelback pouch, but also to not take up space if you don't have a Camelback. For the hiking. So you need some you can access, like a water bottle, where you can be walking and just pull it out. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Damn, there's so much.
Electronics.
This is an essay.
And a lot of backpacks now have this, you know, but you have a little slide where you put your laptop or your electronics or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And actually, I've talked to other designers, like this one company, they gave me a test pack, and there's like a special cubicle for your shoes. Well, I have size 13 feet. My shoes didn't fit in there.
Damn.
And it's like, don't try to be too smart.
Yeah.
Because like you design a pack with too many snazzy cubicles, and it's like they're doing your thinking for you. It's like at the end of the day, just give me a stuff sack and I'll put my socks in there and I'll put the stuff sack where it makes sense to put it. You don't need to hyper engineer this place with your special compression chambers and apartments. Just don't be smarter than me.
Pockets. I like pockets, but not for any reason. And just like, let me figure out what I want to put where.
Yeah.
But some separators that are in there that I can use.
Maybe like some separators, but even ones that are a Velcro that they can be a separator if you want it, or it can just be a
you can pull it out.
A neck pillow if you want that. So that could be the challenge. Task. Yeah.
You ever use a vacuum sealer? Vacuum like compacts all your stuff?
No, but they have versions of that. They have compressors with a strap. They have have you used vacuum sealer?
Well, there's these little pouches and you put your stuff in, then you just squeeze it and it'll let the air out, but not back in until you unscrew. And then it's just like way smaller.
My philosophy on that is that's just a trick to make you pack too much.
Right.
Fair, so one advantage of a 30 liter pack is that you have to make decisions. And that really, you know, I traveled around the world with no luggage 14 years ago. God, feels like yesterday. And once you make the decision, you realize you don't need that much, you know?
Yeah.
I'm sure that the vacuum packing thing works in some situations. But as long as you're not afraid to wash your clothes regularly, you don't really need that much.
Yeah.
And like rent your climbing gear or whatever.
Yeah, pack smart. Okay, so now let's wrap this up. There's a few things I get to usually in these episodes.
Gotcha.
That I try to do. It's. I'll come back to it, but it's travel tip, just one. Gotcha. You'll be on this podcast multiple times. So it's one, and then also a place that's been calling you.
Ooh. Travel tip. I would say, slow down.
There's a billion of them, so.
There's a billion. Yeah. Go slow. I think this interview, we talked about how as a default, people overdo it. You know, they try to do too many things at once. Slow down, let the place travel through you. Nice. And then pack light. We were just talking about it. So I'll add that, get a small pack and force yourself to make decisions, because otherwise you'll dream of yourself with this cool little travel accessory on the other side of the world, not realizing that you don't really need the travel accessory, and that, actually, they sell socks in Myanmar too.
Dude, when I left for Asia, I was like, well, let me get like 10 things of toothpaste because I won't be able to find it. I'm glad I didn't. But I was like, you're going to be able to find toothpaste, you idiot.
Speaking of toothpaste.
Slow down though. I'm going to give that as the one for you. Slow down.
Slow down for sure. Yeah.
See things. What do you mean? Like less itinerary? Or just like.
Yeah. Just know that you're going to be smarter when you get there. You're going to be learning things every day. And so if you have this really packed itinerary that is trying to jam a bunch in, then you're not realizing that you're going to be smarter when you get there. And just walking around and talking to people is going to give you more options. And if you're rushing from place to place based on what you thought you wanted to see, you're not going to have time for what you really want to see when you see it, you know, when you get there.
I had two things I wanted to do in Southeast Asia for anywhere between 2 and 8 months. When I went, it was Bagan and what are those big islands that go right up at the edge of Vietnam?
In Vietnam, Halong Bay.
Mm-hmm. I only got to one of those two.
Okay.
in four months, and it was like fine.
Yeah, for years, my first vagabonding thing through Southeast Asia, I had like everything, I had all these ideas, including Malaysia and Indonesia. And it was 20 years before I got to Malaysia and Indonesia that I realized that it was better to throw that research away for the time being and just enjoy Thailand and Laos and Vietnam and later Myanmar than to try and do something based upon what I thought I wanted to see and those countries are still going to be there, right? You know, just eat your vegetables and live long and there'll be time to get all those places.
Yeah. All right. What did you want to say about where do you want to go?
About where I want to go?
Yeah.
Well, I am... where I want to go is where I'm going. So I'm going to Vanuatu and to Bali.
Where's Vanuatu? You've never been to Bali.
Vanuatu is down by Papua New Guinea. It's in Melanesia.
Okay. Melanesia?
Yeah, it's...
I'll do this instead.
Oh, there it is.
Oh, wow. That's out there.
Yeah.
Vanuatu?
Yeah, Vanuatu. It used to be called the New Hebrides.
I'm sure. Oh, there we
Melanesian,
go.
Melanesian. Yeah, there it is. And there's like 80 islands and 200 languages spoken in Vanuatu. Like every valley has its own language.
Yeah, the Solomon Islands. I think that's where New Year's gets rung in.
Yeah.
First or something.
Yeah, maybe I didn't realize how far south it is.
Damn, that is nowhere.
Yeah, I've never been to the South Pacific.
Edge of the world, really?
Yeah. And so
Hawaii's up there.
I mean, I've been to Hawaii and I've been to New Zealand and Australia, but I've never been to like the small islands of the South Pacific before. I've never been to Melanesia, so it's a Melanesian culture.
Wow. Fiji, there's whatever. Wow.
Yeah, I'm going to go to Fiji. I'm going to spend like 4 nights in Fiji and then 3 weeks in Vanuatu.
Vanuatu, I mean, damn.
Yeah.
Looks really like relaxing.
Relaxing, not sort of in a, well, actually, Vanuatu is like, some Australians go there for like a relaxing holiday, but it's really primitive.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in the pejorative sense. I mean that there's entire islands where there's just a few flushing toilets.
Oh.
And that you're going from village to village on people who live very traditional lives.
Wow.
Actually, the missionaries have made it there. It's a very Christian place. It's also very animistic.
Animist.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I am.
Okay,
if I had
cool.
to pick my religion, I think it's that.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Yeah.
It's land specific, so it might be hard to be a true animist and live in Manhattan, New York City.
Yeah, I think true. There's so little soil and wood that you touch.
They're informed by landscape. Oh, but like Werner Herzog, if you watch much Werner Herzog, he has a documentary about volcanoes. Like the island of Tana has this volcano. It's one of three in the world where you basically look down right into the lava. You can always go down and look down into the lava. And that's affected the religion on that island. Actually, that's where the cargo cults are. Have you heard of cargo cults?
Uh-uh.
Where they believe, it was affected by World War II to an extent, that they believe in this guy named John Frum, who was going to say, I'm going to bring you a lot of stuff. And then World War II soldiers came and gave them all this stuff. They were these wealthy people. There's a lot of black soldiers and Melanesians have kinky hair and dark skin. And so they were so impressed that these soldiers that look like them were there with all of these supplies and machines. Look it up. There's a Wikipedia, long Wikipedia plate where cargo cult, where basically they think the Messiah is basically going to be an American. And instead of bringing them eternal life, he's going to bring them crates and crates of cool stuff. I'm sorry if you're a cargo cult member and I paraphrased the religion wrong.
The religion moves chiefly, but wow. Okay. Yeah. Oh, this is going to be a Patreon episode. For sure.
Oh my God. I would love to talk about it when I come back.
Yeah. But, when you get back from Vanuatu, for sure. Yeah, that's an episode.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about Ari Shaffir's podcast and comedy tours, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.